This is the Oncozine Brief on UK Health Radio with Peter Hofflin.
In this episode of the Oncozine Brief, I'm talking with Dr. Ray Mylik, Chief Medical Officer and Senior Vice President Research and Development at G1 Therapeutics. Dr. Mylik leads the company's clinical development, medical affairs, regulatory affairs, biometrics, translational medicine, and preclinical teams. In a talk with Dr. Robert Epstein, an epidemiologist with extensive expertise in pharmacoeconomics and health outcomes research. He served in academia and public health prior to joining the private sector. Dr. Epstein is currently the Chief Executive Officer and co-founder of Epstein Health and has provided strategic consultancy services to life science companies. I talked with them about the burden of chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression. The side effects of chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression remain a major source of concern for both patients and healthcare providers. And the consequences include anemia, thrombocytopenia, and neutropenia, all of which can cause severe complications and limit the ability of the patients to receive chemotherapy on time and at the standard of care doses. Chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression is one of the most common dose-limiting complications of cancer treatment and is associated with a range of symptoms that can significantly impact patients' health-related quality of life. Despite the current availability and use of various supportive care interventions, chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression places a substantial burden on patients with advanced solid tumors, implicating and impacting many aspects of their daily life. In our interview today, we also talk about G1 Therapeutics' first-in-class FDA-designated breakthrough therapy designed to improve outcomes for people with cancer who are treated with chemotherapy, and we talk about myelopreservation, which may reduce chemotherapy-related toxicity, making chemotherapy safer and more tolerable, and also reduce the need for rescue interventions that address the effects of myelosuppression, such as growth factors or blood and platelet transfusions. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncozine Brief. The Oncozine Brief is developed in collaboration with our online journal, Oncozine, at oncozine.com, spelled oncozine.com, where you can find additional information and latest news about cancer, cancer diagnosis and treatment, and cancer prevention. For information on how to support the program, visit our website at oncozine.com. And if you're living in the United States and want to receive our newsletter, text the word cancer to 66866, and we will make sure that you'll receive our newsletter, which includes an overview of the latest news in oncology and hematology. Now, let's listen to the interview with Dr. Ray Mylik and Dr. Robert Epstein. With me on the phone is Dr. Raj Mylik. He is the Chief Medical Officer and Senior Vice President of a company called G1 Therapeutics. And also is Dr. Robert Epstein. He's an epidemiologist with extensive background in pharmacoeconomics and health outcomes. And so this morning, we're going to talk a little bit about a side effect of a result of chemotherapy called myelosuppression, and what can be done about this, what has been done about this, and why this is such an important but it's an important development to look at opportunities to treat patients, make sure that their cancer can go away, but the side effects might be also reduced. Having said that, welcome to our program. Welcome to the Oncozine Brief, Dr. Mylik, Dr. Epstein.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So let me start, Dr. Epstein, with you. Tell me a little bit about myelosuppression. Well, in the introduction, I mentioned the fact that it has to do with chemotherapy, but can you tell me a little bit more about what causes this and what are the side effects? How bad is it?
Sure. Yeah, certainly. Let me first say myelosuppression can be caused by chemotherapy, frequently is, but it can also be caused by nutritional deficiency, some viruses, even some rare diseases that cause bone marrow failure. But the most common area is chemotherapy. And to really understand how that happens, we have to talk about of the bone marrow itself. And our bone marrow obviously is an important organ. We produce all of our red cells and our white cells and our platelets there. And we need those to carry around in our bloodstream oxygen to our tissues, to fight infections, and to cause our blood to clot if we happen to bleed. There are more than 100 chemotherapy agents out there, and according to which one's used, any of these three cell lines can be reduced or suppressed, or even all three. And how it happens is kind of simple. As you are, I'm sure, aware, chemotherapy goes after fast-dividing cells, and cancers are fast-dividing, so that's the good news. The bad news is there's other parts of us that are also fast-dividing, like our hair, or the lining of our gut, and the bone marrow progenitor cells, the cells that are going to differentiate and become one of these three cell lines I spoke about. So how this happens is that it's an off-target side effect of chemotherapy. It's just attacking another fast-growing dividing cell, and it's not uncommon either.
And you mentioned fast-dividing cells, that meaning that, for example, you mentioned your hair, the line of the gut. That is also where people outside of myelosuppression would find initial side effects, with losing their hair, maybe having gastrointestinal problems. So that's some of the combination of problems that you can see.
Yes, those are all sort of the off-target effects of chemotherapy. They're unfortunate, but they do occur. And you know, until we did our study, I don't know that we really understood the patient impact as much.
Now if we focus on myelosuppression a little bit. Of course, I mean, it's something that you don't want to see in a patient. But what are the effects of myelosuppression? What are patients experiencing?
Yeah, good question. There's really three areas. Anemia is one of them. If the myelosuppression is focusing on your red blood cells and causing anemia, patients can feel extreme fatigue. They're so tired they can barely get out of the house or do anything. And if you have cardiovascular disease or some other illness that requires you to have a lot of red cells carrying oxygen to those tissues, it can make that worse. So if you're a person with angina or, you know, some other problem, you really don't want to have severe anemia. The second area is neutropenia, or low white cells. And we need our white cells, obviously, to attack infections. And the way people know they have this problem frequently is that they develop infections and sometimes fever. And these can happen anywhere, but among all the problems with myelosuppression, having fever with low white count is probably the most dangerous, can even lead to hospitalization and mortality. And the third area would be platelets. These are also coming from your bone marrow. They're the things that help your blood clot. So you would notice that you were not making enough of these if you had bruising or bleeding in your gums or nose bleeding or dark urine or even rectal bleeding. So having any one of these is bad enough. Having three of these at the same time is pretty intense.
Now I can only imagine that the quality of life, the health-related quality of life, as we call it, is definitely impaired in such a case. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, there's been a number of studies conducted over the years looking at quality of life, and absolutely, chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression affects all sorts of things in your life. It's not just fatigue and physical functioning, but emotional. Some people develop depression. There's difficulties in relationships with family members, and you know, a lot of social isolation. People feel lonely because they can't go out for fear of infection.
Now, there's a lot of attempts made over the last decades to eliminate the side effects of myelosuppression, but also other side effects that people may have. Some of them are successful, some of them are not. I mean, I can only imagine that in the case of another kind of major problem where people are feeling nauseated, and that's caused by the chemotherapy, there are a lot of potential treatments for this. This is another an area where we're looking at. So you've investigated this a little bit, you've studied this a little bit. Why do this study?
Well, we did the study because, to your point, there are rescue medications or treatments or transfusions that people can take to counterbalance, you know, these problems with myelosuppression. And there have been many in the scientific community who have felt we have a solution. You know, if you're anemic, we can give you a blood transfusion. If you have low white cells, you know, we can do something about that with a colony stimulating factor. So, or if you're low platelets, we can transfuse you with platelets. So people, you know, generally think these are not great things, but, you know, we've got something, you know, for any one of these three. We found, however, that just even maybe in your life, I know in my life, I've spoken with people who've gone through chemotherapy, and despite the use of these rescue medications, they still feel pretty crummy. And we just wanted to find out, you know, from people around the country. How do people feel? Is it a big deal or isn't it? And in what ways did it impact their care or their treatment? And that was what we were, that's what drove us to look at the, to do the survey in the first place, just to really find out if this was a minor issue or a bigger issue than we might have imagined, and in what areas, and what are people doing about it?
Let's take a break, and then we're back with Dr. Ray Mylik and Dr. Robert Epstein.
Sarcoma. Odds are you've never heard that word before. But for the 40 people diagnosed with sarcoma every day, it is a life-changing word. Life-changing and devastating because sarcoma is cancer. Sarcoma is a cancer of bone and soft tissue more prevalent in children than in adults. More than 6,000 people lose their lives to sarcoma each year. Treatment options for sarcoma are limited, and new therapies are desperately needed. More research and increased awareness is necessary to find a cure for a cancer that you probably didn't even know existed until now. Through awareness, advocacy, and research, the Sarcoma Foundation of America is determined to help those affected by this forgotten cancer, to bring hope to the children and adults whose lives are forever changed by a word they had never heard before. Please help us in the fight to find the cure for sarcoma. For more information on sarcoma and the work of the Sarcoma Foundation of America, please go to curesarcoma.org.
This is the Oncogene Brief on UK Health Radio with Peter Hofflin.
If you're just joining us, this week I'm talking with Dr. Ray Mylik, Chief Medical Officer and Senior Vice President of Research and Development at G1 Therapeutics, and Dr. Robert Epstein, an epidemiologist with extensive expertise in pharmacoeconomics and health outcomes research. Dr. Epstein is also the Chief Executive Officer of Epstein Health. Now, the study is, or the research is published in a journal called Advances in Therapy. Tell me a little bit about your findings.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we interviewed 301 patients who had experienced at least one episode of chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression in the past year, and they had to have had one of three solid tumors, common tumors, lung, breast, or colorectal. And what we found, first of all, the main finding was pretty striking, maybe not, was just striking even to us, but 9 out of 10 people reported to us that chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression had either a moderate or a major impact on their life. And when we looked at the people who are younger, like under 50, they were especially impacted. More than 90% of them felt that this really impacted their life, despite the use of rescue medications. And all areas of functioning were affected, from fatigue to social interactions leading to isolation. One person said her father was dying in a hospital and she couldn't go visit him because she was neutropenic and afraid of infection. Family relationships were affected, and activities of daily living in the home, like ability to clean up or go outside the home, were affected. We also found that nearly 3 out of 10 didn't remember their physicians or nurses warning them about this possibility. And the same proportion, 3 out of 10, didn't really think their oncologist was aware of how uncomfortable they felt. And nearly 30% felt that treatment or rescue for the problem was delayed for one reason or another for them. An additional 2/3 of those that we surveyed said that they had to have chemotherapy dose reductions, maybe skip a cycle or have delays or discontinue the use altogether because of the myelosuppression. And lastly, about 1/3 of patients wound up getting some sort of colony-stimulating factor to boost their white cells. Similar proportion received blood transfusions. Fewer had a problem with or received platelet transfusions. And even any of these rescue medicines or therapies had issues too. With the white cell stimulating factors, people complained about bone pain. And that's a common complaint that's in the label for many of these products. And then even just the logistics of getting to the hospital or the clinic to get the transfusions. And this is even before the pandemic. So you can imagine how people would have answered this question if we did it today.
Right. A big study, quite a few people that you ask questions. The answers that you received, how do they help you adjust therapies? How this is may help treatment opportunities in the future? How important are these results if we try to look at clinical practice today?
I think if we think about today, I'd say it's really important to ask patients, how do they feel? And add that to the blood test results we're looking at. So for example, if someone has a hemoglobin, a red blood cell count of 8, and we're in that wait and see mode of waiting for it to get below 7, if the person's so fatigued they could barely get to the office, we may want to revisit, you know, when do we want to transfuse? Is it really the hard and fast 7, or perhaps we want to loosen that up a little bit in light of their symptoms and jump on it a little earlier. But again, explaining to patients the trade-off. Additionally, you know, because today we are in a pandemic, there are clinicians who may think about an infusion, but they're nervous about bringing the patient back. There are some who are ordering home infusions where that's possible, or an alternative location for these injections or infusions. Many of the infusion suites are closed because you really don't want, you know, all these people sitting in a room together for hours. But there are some that have opened up as single rooms that have extreme cleaning between patients. And believe it or not, there are some centers that are infusing patients in their cars, which I found kind of interesting. For the future, I think it's about avoiding this in the first place. We just don't want patients having to be unnecessarily exposed to others while undergoing any of these rescue treatments.
Now, that is in one thing, of course, and that's really leading, coming out of this research. What struck me was that in looking at the results, you mentioned one thing is that doctors were not necessarily aware of the potential of side effects. They were probably not aware of the harm, or not only the harm, but how severe those side effects can be. I remember a meeting of the European Society of Medical Oncology many, many years ago. This was also brought out as a potential that doctors know how to treat their patients, but often they are not aware of the fact that the side effects can be very debilitating. And one of the things is one of the companies that was presenting there and was not only the poster presentations and other medical stuff, but they were actually creating an event in which doctors had to sit on a bicycle. In this case, it was about fatigue as a result of cancer of chemotherapy, and try to do tasks by sitting on the bicycle, I mean, and trying to get that energy moving in that way. It was a very interesting kind of exercise, but it definitely showed you that the activity level that was being done was way harder than physicians would expect. Now, that goes a little bit to the understanding for physicians about certain treatments. Is that part of medical education that people, that physicians should be taught how important this is?
Well, you know, it's such a common problem with chemotherapeutic agents that it's not a rare event. It's upwards of 50% of patients might develop neutropenia, for example. So any way that we can get better education and communication and empathy into all of our healthcare system for patients who have this problem would be to the benefit of patients.
Now, let me switch gears a little bit and ask Dr. Malik, Raj Malik, you're working for a company that is looking at opportunities to help patients, and you are developing a therapy that is helping a patient with myelosuppression. Tell me a little bit about that. I mean, what can you tell me about the therapy that you are developing? How does that fit in what Dr. Epstein just mentioned?
Yes, thank you. As Dr. Epstein mentioned, you know, myelosuppression remains a condition that is still where the management can be improved. You know, new therapies have not been developed for the treatment of myelosuppression in almost 20 years. So we are developing a drug called trilaciclib. It is a drug that's given intravenously by a 30-minute infusion every time that chemotherapy is given. So the first time and every time that chemo is given, trilaciclib is given just prior to that dose of chemotherapy. And what it does is that it preserves the function of the bone marrow and the immune system from getting damaged by chemotherapy. And as such, can protect the patients from the dangerous side effects of myelosuppression that Dr. Epstein was just mentioning. And what we've also found was that in some settings, patients who receive trilaciclib can actually live longer. You know, despite chemotherapy having the side effects of myelosuppression, it still remains very much a mainstay of cancer treatment, either by itself or in combination with immune checkpoint inhibitors. So, you know, having therapies that can improve management of myelosuppression would be a benefit for patients.
Now, looking at the potential treatments, tell me a little bit about, I would say, the mechanism of action of how this particular drug works, because we know chemotherapy, how that may attack a cancer, how that may result in some side effects. What is this drug doing, what you are developing?
Yeah, so what we learned is that cells in the bone marrow called hematopoietic stem and progenitor cells. So these are the cells that give rise to all of the mature cells like neutrophils, red blood cells, and platelets. In order for these cells to divide, they use an enzyme called cyclin-dependent kinase 4 and 6. And so what trilaciclib is that it's a very potent and selective transient inhibitor of these cyclin-dependent kinases 4 and 6. And when you give it to patients, it actually temporarily pauses the proliferation of these stem and progenitor cells. So in a sense, it puts these cells to sleep while chemotherapy is given, and thereby protects these cells from getting damaged by chemotherapy. And so this is what we mean when we describe myelopreservation. The same mechanism also preserves the function and activation of certain immune cells within the tumor microenvironment.
Let's take a break, and then we're back with our interview with Dr. Ray Mylik and Dr. Robert Epstein. We talk about the burden of chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression, G1 Therapeutics' first-in-class FDA-designated breakthrough therapy designed to improve outcomes for people with cancer who are treated with chemotherapy, and we talk about myelopreservation, which may reduce chemotherapy-related toxicity, making chemotherapy safer and more tolerable, and also reduce the need for rescue interventions that address the effects of myelosuppression, such as growth factors or blood and platelet transfusions. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is The Oncogene Brief.
Each day, researchers make new discoveries that bring us closer to the moment when all cancer patients can become survivors. Some days they take small steps. Others, huge discoveries lead to giant leaps forward. This progress, both small steps and giant leaps, happens with the help of clinical trials. Clinical trials are a fundamental path to progress and the brightest torch researchers have to light their way towards better treatments. And if you've been diagnosed with cancer, they may be your brightest ray of hope. Clinical trials introduce new hope in addition to the current standard of care by allowing researchers to provide participants access to cutting-edge and potentially life-saving treatments. So if you're interested in exploring new treatment options while helping to light the path for other patients, clinical trials may be the best choice for you. Speak with your doctor and visit standuptocancer.org/clinicaltrials to learn more about clinical trials. Together, we can stand up for all of us.
This is the Oncogene Brief on UK Health Radio with Peter Hofland.
And welcome back. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncogene Brief. One of the things that you refer to as myelopreservation, that is the mechanism in which you avoid the development of myelosuppression. Tell me a little bit about that mechanism in which you can avoid certain side effects.
Yeah, so I think first it's just important to understand sort of the current state of the art. So the current approaches do not really protect the function of the bone marrow. And in fact, we refer to these as reactive approaches. And by that, what we mean is that they're given after the chemotherapy damage has already happened. So for example, growth factors are given to stimulate the proliferation of these damaged progenitor cells after the chemo has already done the damage, because these cells are rapidly dividing. And the same goes for red cell transfusions, where if a patient has significant anemia, the transfusion is to really improve the patient's symptoms as a result of that anemia. So we refer to these type of management approaches as really lineage specific. So in other words, they're focused just on the neutrophil lineage or the red cell lineage. So trilaciclib is really, it's a novel approach. So myelopreservation is a novel approach that by preserving bone marrow and immune system function during chemo has the potential to impact multiple lineages. In other words, more than just neutrophils and red cells and also platelets. So we conducted three randomized placebo-controlled trials with trilaciclib in small cell lung cancer. And what we found in each individual trial, and also when we looked at the data combined together, is that patients who received trilaciclib had less chemotherapy-related toxicity and the need for these rescue interventions. In other words, less G-CSF and transfusions. They also had significantly less neutropenia and anemia. And I think what is really important as well, and this ties into the important research that Dr. Epstein just described, is that the patient showed improvement in patient-reported outcomes, resulting in an improvement in their experience while they received chemotherapy. So this was particularly manifested in fatigue and functioning related to anemia. So therefore, trilaciclib as a single agent really provides benefits in more than one lineage and can improve the patient's experience while receiving chemotherapy.
One of the effects is that, or potential treatment standard approach that we do right now is transfusion. Is this drug limiting the need for transfusion?
Yes. What we found was that patients who received trilaciclib actually had fewer transfusions. So both the number of patients who needed transfusions and the number of transfusions that were given were less in the trilaciclib group than in the placebo group. And I think this also going back to a comment Dr. Epstein made earlier about the current COVID pandemic. You know, right now, the availability of blood supply is also an issue. So if we can reduce the need for red blood cell transfusions, then that's obviously a good thing, not just for patients, but also for, you know, society in general.
And is there a way that you would potentially eliminate that need?
Yes, but potentially so.
Now, looking at your research, if I understand correctly, this is being studied in a number of cancers, including lung cancer, breast cancer, and I understand also another form of cancer in which you tried this. Tell me a little bit about the effects in those groups of people.
Yes. So in addition to the three studies we conducted in small cell lung cancer, we conducted one study in metastatic triple negative breast cancer. And the findings here were also very interesting, where we showed a significant improvement in survival for the patients that received trilaciclib. We also found that patients were able to tolerate more cycles of chemotherapy without an increase in toxicity. And these patients also had a reduced rate and need for red cell transfusions. So the transfusion benefit was seen in the triple negative breast cancer patients, in addition to the small cell lung cancer patients. Our patient reported outcome data was also consistent with what we saw in small cell lung cancer.
Now you mentioned a survival benefit, right? Now, this particular drug is not made to treat the cancer, but to treat the potential of side effects, myelosuppression. How does it help in extending or give this benefit in extending life? How does that work?
Yeah, so we believe under certain circumstances that we could see an improvement in, you know, potential improvement in survival. And we'll be, of course, testing this in further studies. So we think there could be a couple of different hypotheses for why we saw this in the triple negative study. The first is that patients were able to receive more chemotherapy and they were able to tolerate it better. And the reason they were able to receive more chemotherapy is because their disease was not progressing. So therefore, that meant that we were actually having some impact on the tumor as well. The second is we believe there could be also an immune hypothesis here where we could activate the tumor microenvironment within the tumor itself, and this could also enhance anti-tumor activity. So there are data with other CDK4/6 inhibitors on this immune-enhancing effect. So this is also an area that we will be exploring in further studies.
Now, let's switch gears a little bit, go back to Dr. Epstein. When you hear this and you look at potential next steps in research with this particular development, what G1 is doing, but also further beyond this, what are you looking at?
Well, I'd say that the results that Dr. Malik described are pretty striking and important, but all by themselves. I know it's just, you know, a form of lung cancer, small cell, and not other solid tumors, with the exception of the single study in breast, but reducing the need for transfusions and allowing patients to receive more doses, like the standard number of doses and cycles of chemo, has got to be good. There was interesting two publications in the last few years that looked at the use of digital tracking patients at home for their side effects on chemotherapy, and having a mechanism to alert physicians or nurses when these side effects occurred and jumping on them earlier. And in both cases, they found that by having that kind of a system in place, you can get ahead of the game, not wait for the next visit, but get on top of it, you know, earlier, keep them on their chemo and reduce mortality. So I think, you know, in a way, the drug that he was describing, Dr. Malik was describing, is doing that. It's jumping on it and preventing it in the first place and allowing people to stay on their chemo. So I think that's all very encouraging. Looking forward to seeing, you know, more research on this topic, other tumor types, different chemotherapy regimens. But in general, I think it's pretty exciting.
So I think you address this a very interesting point. It is not only the chemotherapy, it's not only trying to have a rescue drug or a drug that actually helps avoid or limit the side effects that may be out there. It's also making sure that patients are aware of certain side effects and really monitoring them to get in the game early to avoid those side effects. In that respect, what do patients need to know and how can doctors help them to get there?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is patients need to know that chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression is a common side effect. You know, we found that nearly 30% didn't even know about it until they got it. So it's pretty important. And then maybe they just didn't hear it the first time, you know, the information about it. But I think the healthcare team should repeat multiple times, you know, these are the benefits, these are the risks, this is what can happen, this is how many people get this problem, this is what it means, this is the kind of rescue therapies, et cetera. So up front, I think there's a good opportunity for better communication between patients and the healthcare team to get it all clear. I think the second message for patients, from my perspective, and this sounds kind of perverse, but the good news about myelosuppression is that if your other counts are coming down, you know the chemotherapy is doing something to fast-growing cells. So you should feel, you know, thank goodness, must be working on my tumor. That's not a great reason to be taking chemotherapy, but at least it's showing that it's doing something. The third thing I'd say is to patients, if you develop any of the symptoms of myelosuppression and you're at home, you need to get in touch with your healthcare team. They need to know about it. And they particularly need to know about it if it's something like fever with infection. That can really be dangerous. So they need to understand that this is not something to tough it out at home. It's important to call their healthcare team and let them know. And then lastly, for today, they should know about these reactive or rescue treatments, which ones are available, what are the risks and what are the side effects, and what are the benefits of either having a transfusion or any of these other treatments.
Let's take a break, and then we're back with our interview with Dr. Ray Mylik, Chief Medical Officer and Senior Vice President, Research and Development at G1 Therapeutics, and Dr. Robert Epstein, an epidemiologist with extensive expertise in pharmacoeconomics and health outcomes research. Dr. Epstein is also the Chief Executive Officer of Epstein Health.
The
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is encouraging cancer patients and survivors to be extra cautious during the COVID-19 pandemic. Cancer treatment, especially chemotherapy, weakens the immune system, making you at higher risk of severe illness. Dr. Lisa Richardson is director of the CDC's Division of Cancer Prevention and Control.
Take these steps to stay healthy. Wash your hands often with soap and water. Clean and disinfect frequently touched surfaces daily. Stay home. If you must leave, keep at least 6 feet between you and others. Avoid touching your face, eyes, nose, and mouth with unwashed hands. If your temperature is 100.4 or higher, call your doctor. Use CDC's coronavirus self-checker to help you make decisions about seeking medical care.
Make sure your caregivers and household members are aware of your higher risk and take precautions. Visit cdc.gov/coronavirus and preventcancerinfections.org for more health tips.
This is the Oncogene Brief on UK Health Radio with Peter Hofflin.
If you're just joining us, this week I'm talking with Dr. Ray Mylik and Dr. Robert Epstein.
You mentioned one thing is education, communication. I can only imagine that if you are a patient and you're sitting in your patient's, you know, doctor's office, or you are with an oncology nurse or patient educator, or whatever may be the case, you're distraught, you're stressed, you may not necessarily be able to retain information. So if you're the physician, what are some of the things that a physician can do to help patients retain that information and to be aware of the fact that side effects occur, that monitoring is important, and that there are potential treatment options?
Yeah. Well, you said the right thing, which is that people are distraught and they are selectively hearing things, and they, you know, not everything processes in the early days of cancer treatment. So several thoughts come to mind. Firstly, the healthcare team should feel comfortable repeating things, asking, did you understand? Do you know what I'm saying? Or, you know, make sure that they can repeat it back. Secondly, having handouts, some kind of information that they can take home with them and read it again at their leisure when they're not sitting in the office. Third thing is selected web links where they could go online and find information for themselves. Fourthly, I would say, as they're monitoring themselves for side effects, they can keep a symptom diary. You know, they're using a regular diary or any which way is most convenient for the patient. And then lastly, I think I would identify the member of the care team you'd like them to call if they're getting into trouble. Sometimes patients are less comfortable calling their oncologist with something, you know, like fatigue, but they might be more comfortable calling the nurse. So identifying the who and the team, you know, would take that contact information. And I guess the last point would be when patients come back for visits, it's time to bring your diary with you, share the information about, you know, whether you could take all your medicines or you're having so many side effects you couldn't, and how you're feeling.
It's the role between the physician as well as the patient, the healthcare team and the patient. How important is it for the patient to have a family member, a friend, or other patient advocates with them? And how important is that role of the patient advocate in that case?
Oh, I think it's very important. A lot of the patients in our survey had caregivers or family members who came with them, who drove them there. Oftentimes, you know, these solid tumors with chemotherapy occur in older people who, you know, are compromised and not feeling comfortable enough to drive into the office by themselves. So it's a good idea, if possible, to have a family member or caregiver with you and have them taking notes too, because now you have two listeners to the information and they can help each other and support one another after they go home.
Now, let's switch gears again for a little bit. Talking about the drug that Dr. Mylik, your company is developing. Tell me a little bit about your focus with this drug. And importantly, this is still in clinical development, if I'm not mistaken here. What is the regulatory pathway to get this to the patients ultimately?
Yes. So, you know, our current focus at G1 for trilaciclib is, you know, really first and foremost to get it FDA approved and make it available to patients with small cell lung cancer receiving chemotherapy. You know, everything we've talked about in terms of how much chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression is still an issue and how patients are, you know, are suffering from the consequences of that. You know, having a drug like trilaciclib who could potentially, or that can potentially help, is obviously, we think, would be really helpful for patients. So we're absolutely focused on getting the drug approved. In addition, we're obviously preparing to commercialize it in the U.S., and we're doing that. We'll be doing that ourselves, and are building out our commercial infrastructure, our medical affairs infrastructure. And we recently announced, and we're very excited about, a co-promotion agreement that we entered into with Boehringer Ingelheim, so that we can also use their oncology sales force, which is very experienced, to really help get trilaciclib to patients. Beyond the initial indication, we think that trilaciclib could really have the potential to help any patient who receives chemotherapy, whether it's chemotherapy alone or with chemotherapy plus immune checkpoints. And so we're planning additional studies. Based on the data that I described earlier about triple-negative breast cancer, we're collaborating with a well-known group of investigators in breast cancer that are studying early-stage breast cancer. And this is a study that's called I-SPY 2, with the goal of improving not only the outcome for patients with early-stage breast cancer, but potentially also the tolerability of those treatments. And so trilaciclib started in that study last quarter. And then we're also expecting to initiate a phase 3 study in colorectal cancer in the fourth quarter of this year. And that's a tumor type, along with other malignancies of the gastrointestinal tract, where highly myelosuppressive chemotherapy is used. So we're hopeful that it could also be, useful in those settings. We've had many collaborative meetings with the FDA, and we submitted the NDA in June of this year. And trilaciclib was, given breakthrough therapy designation by the FDA. We anticipate hearing about the PDUFA date in August of 2020, and assuming approval, working towards launching in early 2021.
We're getting close to the end of our show today. If you are a physician, or if you are a patient, and you are would like to have more information, for example, you'd like to know a little bit more about participating in clinical trials if you're a patient, or if you're a doctor, you have a number of physicians or number of patients that potentially qualify to participate in clinical trials, where can you find more information?
Yes. So, we have a lot of information on trilaciclib, including all of our publications and meeting presentations. Those are all on our website and so readily accessible for anyone. Any trials that we conduct are on publicly available websites like clinicaltrials.gov. So all of that information should be accessible.
Well, Dr. Malik, Dr. Epstein, thank you very much for your time this morning. I think we learned a lot about myelosuppression, about the potential treatment options, and how patients can benefit from that. Thank you very much, and stay safe, stay healthy.
And yeah, thank you.
That's important,
you too.
I mean, especially under COVID, right? And thank you very much for your time this morning.
You're welcome.
Great. Thank you
so
much.
In today's edition of the Oncogene Brief, I spoke with Dr. Ray Mylik and Dr. Robert Epstein. We spoke about the burden of chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression. Data from a study published early this year in Advances in Therapy highlights that despite the various methods used to address chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression and a patient-focused approach of oncologists, the real-world impact of chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression on patients is substantial. Based on the results of the study, the authors conclude that improving communication between patients and healthcare providers may help improve patients' understanding of chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression and foster shared decision-making in terms of treatment. For more information about chemotherapy-induced myelosuppression and G1 therapeutics, visit the company's website at g1therapeutics.com. That is G and then number one, therapeutics.com. For us here at the Oncogene Brief, we want to thank you, our listeners, sponsors, and advertisers, for your ongoing support. Your support makes it possible that you can hear this program via PRX, Public Radio Exchange, and in the United Kingdom and mainland Europe via UK Health Radio. And you can also download our program via podcast and streaming media, including iTunes and Spotify. For more information about supporting the Oncogene Brief, go to oncogene at oncogene.com. If you're living in the United States and want to receive our newsletter, text the word cancer to 66866, and we will make sure that you'll receive our newsletter, which includes an overview of the latest news in oncology and hematology. Thank you all, and thank you for listening. And join us again for our next episode. I'm Peter Hoffland, and this is the Oncogene Brief.
The Oncogene Brief is produced for Sun Valley Communication by Peter Hoffland, Sonia Portillo, Evan Wendt, David Kaler, and distributed by InPress Media Group. Support for the Oncogene Brief comes from listeners of this station and our commercial underwriters and advertisers. For more information about underwriting and sponsoring options, visit our website at oncogene.com/underwriting. The Oncogene Brief contains health and medicine-related information and is provided for educational and entertainment purposes only. The content is not intended as a substitute for professional medical or health advice and does not replace your doctor's advice. Your doctor is the best person to answer questions about your personal health. If you hear something in this program that doesn't agree with what your doctor has told you, ask him or her about it.